You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead this hour, we look at two of this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. Have you seen Nomadland or Promising Young Woman? What do you think of these films? Join in 800-642-1234. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about another vaccine.
Decades before COVID-19, there was an epidemic story with a successful ending. During the 20th century, Americans pulled together to defeat the polio virus, putting their faith in scientists and public health guidelines. Writer Dean Robbins tells us more about how Wisconsin played a part in this heroic effort.
Between the 1910s and the 1950s, polio was the stuff of American nightmares. The disease paralyzed or killed hundreds of thousands, particularly children. In 1937, the city of Milwaukee ordered 15,000 kids to stay home from school to prevent infections. During other outbreaks, Kenosha and Janesville closed their beaches. In the La Crosse Tribune, Staff Loveland described contracting polio at age 5 and becoming a quadriplegic. When Lonnie Miller of Westby was stricken in 1952, a janitor wearing gloves came into his classroom, removed his desk, and burned it, along with his textbooks and pencils. That's how scared people were of spreading the virus.
This year, the enemy, poliomyelitis, struck with such impact and fury that it shook the entire nation.
In our day, the coronavirus sparked a culture war, with people arguing over masks and social distancing. By contrast, 20th century Americans formed a united front against polio. President Franklin Roosevelt encouraged ordinary citizens to donate their spare change to polio research through the March of Dimes. Millions answered the call, from scout troops to church groups. Waitresses donated their tips, and children competed to see who could collect the most donations during Halloween. Dimes poured into the White House. The campaign was a boon for scientists, particularly Dr. Jonas Salk. The passionate young virologist saw children in leg braces and iron lungs and vowed to relieve their suffering. In 1948, he began working on a polio vaccine that would create what he called freedom from fear. Salk made a breakthrough in 1952, and 2 years later, his vaccine was the subject of a national field trial. Once again, Americans joined together on a vast scale. 3 million people helped raise funds for the biggest medical test in history, representing a unique collaboration among scientists, doctors, and the public. Run by volunteers across 44 states, including Wisconsin, it planned inoculations for nearly 2 million elementary school children. The volunteer army was 300,000 strong, including doctors, nurses, and teachers. Kids got a series of 3 shots and a pin that proclaimed them polio pioneers. Paula Brown Sinclair remembers participating in Eau Claire and being hailed as a local hero. When researchers declared the vaccine a success on April 12, 1955, Americans showed their gratitude.
It's a day of triumph for 40-year-old Dr. Jonas E. Salk, developer of the vaccine.
Shopkeepers painted, "Thank you, Dr. Salk," on their windows. Composers wrote waltzes in his honor. Young Terry Doblin of Milwaukee sent Salk a letter calling him a small man with a big mind. Polio cases plummeted, and within 6 years, the disease had almost vanished in the United States. Decades later, in the Kenosha News, Charles Licht recalled his youthful participation in the national field trial. He marveled over what he and his fellow citizens had accomplished. "Being a polio pioneer was, perhaps, the most important thing I have done in my life," he said. "We and Jonas Salk eradicated polio."
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison and author of the children's picture book, Thank You, Dr. Salk. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And now for some Oscar buzz. On Fridays in April, we're making space to talk about this year's Best Picture nominees leading up to the Academy Awards on Sunday the 25th. So next up, it's Nomadland, starring the one and only Frances McDormand.
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am. I know.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
My mom said that you're homeless. Is that true?
No, I'm not homeless. I'm just houseless. Not the same thing, right?
All right, morning movie critics, bring on your reviews, your Oscar predictions, 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaching courses on film. Anna, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, good morning. And you'll have to maneuver us through the plot line here of Nomadland without spoilers. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So it follows our protagonist is Fern. Fern, played by Frances McDormand in this kind of really remarkable performance. And Fern is from the town of Empire, Nevada. And we learn at the start of the film that the zip code for Empire has essentially been decommissioned because the town has essentially been abandoned. It's a company town. And the town, I think it was home to a gypsum plant. And it, because of the Great Recession, there's no longer any need for this product that's used in, I think, kind of sheetrock, in the production of sheetrock. And so Fern's husband is also dead in the film. And so she has, you know, kind of, you know, no job, no husband. And the film just follows Fern as she sort of embarks on this, the title of the film, on this nomadic existence, as she traverses the country and takes these kinds of jobs, these temporary jobs. We see a lot of Amazon warehouses. She works at Amazon warehouses, but she does takes on other sorts of jobs that are sort of transient positions. And, you know, along with Fern's journey, we get to see a lot of the American West. Mm. And that is particularly what is so beautiful about the film, is the cinematography, kind of the showing America.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, that is something that is particularly, I think, wanted right now, as we've all been confined to our homes, is this kind of getting to go along with Fern on her journey.
Yeah, you know, Condé Nast Traveler called it a love letter to America's wide open spaces. So certainly there is that. But there's also this tension, right? There's this romance associated with the nomad lifestyle, but the reality is it's not romantic at all. There's the poverty, the desperation. What do you make of that tension?
Well, I mean, that too is, you know, it's a window into low wage work. Mm. And the fact that, you know, it's really hard to make a living doing these kinds of jobs that are so difficult. You know, the kinds of jobs, you know, really there that so many of us have no appetite for, you know, cleaning bathrooms at truck stops, for example. And, you know, shows too just how challenging these warehouse jobs can be, and how physically demanding they are. At one point, she's working at a sugar beet processing factory, and, you know, shoveling in these sugar beets. It's just really intensively labor intensive, and it's a very you know, the kind of work that is so, we obviously learned a lot more about this past year, but it's still work that is invisible to so many of us. And and you know, she's just kind of, you'd think, you know the conventional narrative is all those Amazon jobs pay so well that she could maybe possibly get ahead. But the reality is that she takes these jobs for a few months at a time, and is never truly able to find a foothold.
Yeah.
And living in her van. too. So.
The film largely features amateur actors, including Wanakee native Derek Endres, who plays himself, and he's a houseless migrant worker. He told the Cap Times he's living this existential existence. What does amateur actors bring to this film?
I think they really bring a kind of authenticity to their performances. Chloe Zhao, the director, she's done this before where she's really put amateur actors at the center of her films. And there is a kind of an authenticity that McDormand, clearly as the pro she is able to really bounce off those performances, I think, quite well. And they too, these amateur actors, just are captured in such a revealing, intriguing way. And it's not just him. It's, we have the Bob Wells, the person who is sort of the van life guru, he plays himself. There are two women that are just referred to by their first names in the cast, Linda May and Swanky, portray themselves. And there's just this really, what we are watching when we watch Nomadland, I think, is a kind of an attempt to reveal the real America. Well, when you're using, real people who are essentially portraying variations on themselves, it does lend a kind of, again, that same word I'm coming back to, authenticity to the film, for sure.
Do you think it's that authenticity that is causing it to become a Best Picture nomination? I mean, what is it that is really propelling Nomadland forward?
I think it's a film very much of the moment right now. And there's just so, there's so much right now relating to, wanting to understand more about economic disparity in our country and understanding, the pandemic obviously has revealed all of this, disparity ultimately, and wanting to understand, how do low wage workers get by? What are they doing? How are they making it in the world? Are they making it in the world? And I think that coupled though too with just the glorious scenery, the on location filming in places like the Badlands,
North Dakota,
the desert. There's always, I think, a fascination with the desert in this country. It goes back right now. In fact, I'm teaching a course on the American Western, and I think there are elements in the film that are certainly that kind of appeal to our sensibilities about the American West and the Western, even though it's certainly not your conventional, triumphant John Ford film at all. But it's still just, we take pleasure, I think, still in the beauty of the landscapes that Chloe Zhao has captured in this film.
Anna Thompson Hajek is a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaches courses on film. This is pianist Ludovico Einaudi, his music featured in Nomadland. Which performances did you enjoy watching in Nomadland or Promising Young Woman? Who deserves an Oscar this year? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. By Muna from the Oscar-nominated Promising Young Woman. The song is Nihilist. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So these Fridays in April, we're setting aside time to talk about this year's nominees for Best Picture ahead of the Academy Awards. If you've seen Promising Young Woman, would you recommend it? It's nominated for 5 Oscars. We'll take Best Picture. What do you think of Nomadland? Join in 800-642-1234. We're talking with Anna Thompson Hodgick, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, and she's our guide. Let's bring in Rana now in Rice Lake. Hi, Rana. What do you think of Nomadland?
Hi, good morning. When I first started watching it, I was a little confused. I wasn't quite sure what I was watching. And then as I stuck with it, it just became this beautiful flower that was just opening up right before me. And as I watched the movie and just stayed with it, there were so many parts I could identify. And one of them was, I believe she's in her trailer, and she pulls out an article of clothing, which I think is her husband's or someone's. And she just has this moment of, for me, it seemed to be wanting the old life back and being sorrowful for not having that life currently. And I really related to that. It just made the movie so current for me and just so real that I ended up just ranting and raving about it and loving it in the end. So thank you. That's really all I had.
Thank you, Rana. So it really blossomed, and there's some of that yearning in it, Anna.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, our caller, you know, discussed here the relatability of that narrative. And I think, you know, that I think is so revealing that, you know, this past year has been, you know, very traumatic for so many Americans. And you know, this particular narrative is dealing more with the fallout of the Great Recession of 2008, 2007, 2008. And so I think, but you know, that it's still, again, as it is this movie of the moment that so many people can connect with because of the grief, the loss that Fern is feeling, and how she's sort of dealing with that grief and loss is how we learn more about her throughout the journey of the film.
Well, let's switch gears here and go to the next film, Promising Young Woman. Can you give us a plot line here?
So this follows also kind of a story of grief and loss in a very different light. And this is the story of Cassie. And we learn kind of early on about Cassie that she is somebody that has experienced a trauma in her past. And it's ultimately a friend of hers. And she was once in medical school with her friend. And the friend is a childhood friend. And they, her friend has ultimately, and I guess I'll just say here, spoiler alert, it's hard to explain a lot of this film without giving away some spoilers.
Yeah.
But her friend was sexually assaulted in medical school. Her friend subsequently commits suicide, and Cassie is sort of haunted by this. And her method of dealing with this trauma is to, you know, once or twice a week, go out and seduce men and pretend to be under the influence and get these men to take her home. And then, you know, when she is, you know, kind of gets right to that point where these men seem like they're going to step over the boundary, she immediately becomes sober and kind of calls out these men for their behavior.
How does the film take on rape culture and the kind of the grim consequences of rape culture?
Well, I think it does so in a very very dark way, ultimately. And you know, there's a number of commentators that have said that this is a kind of almost a therapeutic action for Cassie, that she does this over and over again. And I think, you know, it's a black comedy. Cassie in the end seems to have the last laugh. But there's a lot of really dark things that happen throughout the film in terms of her ability to convey a kind of social justice meted out. And I think it leaves the viewer wondering, is it enough? Is the way that this film is resolved? Is it enough? Is it dealt with in a way that brings a kind of closure? And I'm not really sure if I have the answer to that, but I think the film uses comedy. It uses some tropes that we're familiar with, like for a good portion of the film, we think we're sort of watching a kind of romantic comedy, in a way, but it is not ultimately. It is a revenge story. It is a story of revenge. It's a story, I think, in some respects, shares some overlap with a movie like the Kill Bill films. And so, if you are If you are a fan of those kinds of films, there are elements to Promising Young Woman that may appeal to you. But it is certainly a movie about sexual trauma, and it's a movie that is difficult to handle in some respects. So if that is something that you are disturbed by more broadly, I probably wouldn't recommend it. But I think that the director, and I believe the writer, Emerald Fennell, is doing something different here. Yeah. And that I think that's why she's the film has been recognized. It puts a spin on a film, on a kind of narrative that is so often women don't get that justice that they deserved, or so often they are you know, saved by the man in the end. You know, that doesn't happen. There's no princess being whisked away in the end, at the end of this film. It's a film that is rather bleak, but it is a movie that is, I think, too, that the main character, Cassie, is doing things on her own terms.
But what I really want to get out of you and ask you about this film, does it romanticize the notion of girl power? Does it get girl power wrong?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I think I don't think it romanticizes girl power in the end because of the way the film ultimately does end. Mm. But it, I don't know about that. But I do think that it the movie is a little bit too tidy in its resolution too. Okay, so this is the big spoiler. So if you do want to see this film, I feel like I can't talk about it without...
But please come back to the morning show. All right, carry on.
Right, is that our protagonist, Cassie, she does lose her life in the end. And it's a very violent conclusion to this, to kind of what her character arc is. And there's still a kind of, she still sort of provides closure through some things that she's able to do and set up before the movie ends. Mm. And so that part of it I felt was just a little bit too tidy, and neat in the end, because she put ultimately, I feel like, too much faith in the criminal justice system.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. It was good. Thank you so much.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer, UW-Whitewater. Come back next week for more Oscar Buzz. Every Friday in April, Anna drops by to discuss two of the Best Picture nominees. Next up, Minari and Sound of Metal. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.